pandemic called capitalist corporate greed.
Yeah. People eagerly find fault with capitalism.
If capitalism works, if this is the best we got, why does it seem to give such a raw deal?
A raw deal? Is that what we get? I hear that from people now working for Joe Biden.
Do I look like a radical socialist?
Not especially, but with so many upset about America's wealth disparities. It's time to take a closer look at the socialism these people want.
This is class war!
We are committed to transforming our society into one based on freedom, equality, and solidarity.
The belief that socialism will bring that is why it's now as popular as capitalism among young people. Another big reason is, oddly, this 90-year-old, linguist Noam Chomsky. Students study his work in class, and colleges pay him up to $30,000 to speak.
Thanks very much.
Yet for generations, Chomsky misled students by calling capitalism a grotesque catastrophe. I thought the fall of Soviet communism would put an end to such nonsense. Surely everyone would now see the catastrophe is socialism. But no, socialism has come back strong. So in this video and the next, we'll bust five myths about socialism. The first is the claim that that wasn't real socialism.
The Soviet Union, this was about as remote from socialism as you can imagine.
It's absurd to say that the Soviet Union was remote from socialism.
Economist Ben Powell reminds us that when the Soviets made private business illegal,
that's about as close as the world ever saw to the pure socialist end of the spectrum.
But whenever socialism fails, people always say that wasn't real socialism.
It doesn't prove anything about socialism in other countries.
Working people have to be in control of production. The Soviet Union is the exact opposite of that. Working people had no control over anything.
But that's the problem. That is what socialism inevitably delivers.
Socialism means abolishing private property in the major things that go into production and replacing it with some form of collective ownership. In practice, this means state ownership and control. And the Soviet Union had an abundance of that.
Of course, the Soviet Union is now gone, so some say.
There is no true socialist country that exists today.
But there is. Look at Venezuela.
Just eating is a luxury.
When I say socialism created hardship there, people trash me on my own social media. Read a book. Venezuela's not socialist. Think a bit. I'll do better than that. I'll listen to the politician who wrecked Venezuela.
El capitalismo es el reino de la injusticia.
Because capitalism is tyranny, Hugo Chavez said his government must take over businesses.
¿Y este edificio?
Es un edificio que tiene comercio privado de joyería.
Expropiese. Expropiese.
That's socialism. The socialists turned the richest country in Latin America, the nation with the biggest oil reserves in the world, into the poorest country.
But it's not clear that that crisis has anything to do with their socialist policies.
That's myth two. Venezuela's failure has
little to do with socialism and a lot to do with poor governance.
Some of Chavez's programs could have been sustainable if he pursued a sound economic policy.
Yeah, some of his policies could be sustainable if he had a sound economic policy called capitalism.
Why does it have to be capitalism? Oliver is saying if he just managed it better.
It's a story about epic mismanagement.
Or here's how Al Jazeera puts it.
Economic policies have failed to adjust to reality.
That's the nature of socialism, is for their economic policies to fail to adjust to reality. Because economic reality is evolving every day. It's millions of decentralized entrepreneurs and consumers who are making fine-tuning adjustments to this.
In our capitalist society, when COVID hit,
what did we start seeing? Millions of entrepreneurs adjusting without government orders of how to deliver their products and services.
Servers have switched roles to delivery drivers, while bartenders have turned into sales reps.
Restaurants installed the heat lamps, expanded patios, did delivery.
Although reporters complained about the absence of federal direction, no central authority could possibly direct all these individual adjustments in thousands of different places. In fact, federal direction would have prevented all that.
In a market economy, the great thing is everybody's little adjustments gets tested and we get to see what works.
Blockbuster was great, but then people were offered something better.
TV shows and movies at your command.
By contrast,
In a socialist economy, you get a one-size-fits-all adjustment, and you miss out on this learning process where some entrepreneurs copy others when they see things successful, and they stop doing it when it's not.
For example, East Germany's socialist planners pushed these Trabants.
Bequem für vier Erwachsene.
They said the cars were great.
Wendig. Schnell.
But it was a terrible car. Hard to drive, and it spewed pollution.
Even when West Germans were building Volkswagens, BMWs, and Porsches, East Germans were stuck with Trabants.
In a socialist economy, every one of the minor adjustments needs to be commanded. One mind who has to know all of those teeny adjustments, communicate it down, and get everybody to do the right thing. That's impossible.
No government department can manage millions of individual decisions and prices. When they try, shortages occur, and money loses value.
If you work the whole month, you can buy one hamburger.
Here's another excuse for Venezuela's failure.
Oil prices plummeted in 2014, and Maduro failed to adjust.
Vox made this video called The Collapse of Venezuela Explained. In the whole video, they never mentioned socialism once. They blame falling oil prices.
The oil price is a complete distraction. There's plenty of countries around the world that depend on oil revenue. When oil prices went down, the people there didn't start losing weight. That just happened in Venezuela.
Finally, some people respond to my videos by saying people in Venezuela and Cuba struggle not because of socialism, but because of our sanctions and embargo.
They certainly don't help the people, but it's an afterthought as a reason for their suffering.
In Cuba,
they drive around 1950s U.S. cars, but we don't have a blockade on them. There's no U.S. Navy destroyers preventing Kia, Fiat, or whoever else around the world from sending them cars. The reason for their suffering is they have an economic system that can't deliver.
In our next video, more myths about socialism, like progressives claim that democratic socialism is different.
The key word for them, democratic.
Democratic socialism is your kid's public school.
This is Class War!
In my last video, we covered two big myths about socialism, but we have more. So here's myth three. Socialism brings good things if it's democratic socialism.
The examples of failed socialism that critics use are not socialist democracies, but authoritarian states.
Democratic socialists denounce all that. The key word for them, democratic. They believe that both the government and the economy should be run by the people by way of the ballot box.
Esta es la hora del pueblo bolivariano.
But Venezuela's socialist was elected.
Aquí no hay dictadura. Yo he sido electo aquí tres veces.
They can start off democratically elected, and then once they centralize control over the economy, it becomes impossible to democratically unelect them.
Economist Ben Powell.
Now, Maduro rules while ordering state employees to vote for him or they lose their job.
Maduro blatantly buying votes.
They put food aid stations next to polling places and you get rewarded with rations if you vote correctly. Now democracy there is a sham.
It always becomes authoritarian? Always?
Everywhere you try socialism, that's what you get.
Why?
It's hard to exercise political freedom if you don't have economic freedoms. If you're dependent upon the state for your livelihood, you lose your ability to use your voice to oppose them because you can be punished.
But unfortunately, people don't realize that when they're promoting democratic socialism.
Democratic socialism is your kid's public school.
It's the researchers and scientists paid with our taxes.
It's our interstate highway system.
We're not purely capitalist. There are some industries that are government-owned, operated, and controlled, socialized, if you will. It's no accident that when you look at these and think about things that are inefficiently done and underperforming, our public education, our congested streets, these socialized industries don't work well.
But what about
Norway? It's as socialist as they come.
Instead of Cuba or China, think Sweden.
Myth four, socialism does work well in Scandinavia. But Scandinavian countries are not socialist.
Sweden isn't socialist. Volvo is a private company. Go to restaurants, hotels, they're privately owned. Markets organize the vast majority of Swedish economic activity.
But Sweden
did have a period in the 1970s and 1980s when we had something that resembled socialism, a big government that taxed and spent heavily. There were waiting lines to get health care. People couldn't get the pension that they depended on for the future. At that point, the Swedish population just said, enough, we can't do this.
So Sweden cut taxes and cut government spending. They privatized trains, sold state-owned businesses.
When I talk about democratic socialism, I'm looking at countries like Denmark.
When American politicians wrongly called Scandinavia socialists, Denmark's prime minister came to America to refute them.
Denmark is far from a socialist planned economy. Denmark is a market economy.
In fact, Denmark today is more free market than America.
With much freedom to pursue your dreams and live your life.
Finally, myth five. Socialism is completely different from fascism. When a congressman said,
"The potential is out there for another Hitler, socialist like Hitler, to come along."
Another congressman said he was wrong.
It's the Nazis that's terrible, not the socialists. They were Nazis who killed Jews, and I get offended when you compare socialists to Nazis.
They were fascists.
It's true that fascism and socialism aren't exactly the same, but they do have a lot in common.
They both replace market decision-making with command and control. While socialism abolishes private property and replaces it with state ownership, fascism leaves private ownership in nominal terms, at least, but replaces decision-making with state control and orders. As an average person living your life, whether under socialism or fascism, you lose your autonomy, your control over your own future. Only under capitalism do you have the freedom to say no. Entrepreneurs offer you their services. They offer you employment. You can say no and choose a better path for yourself. You don't get that same type of choice when someone else is planning the economy.
Powell and another economist wrote a book about socialist countries.
We went to Socialism 2018, the biggest gathering of young socialists, and they pointed out lots of problems in the United States, problems with migration, with war, with policing. The problems they were identifying were the product of bad government that the U.S. is giving them, not capitalism.
Socialism appeals because it promises fairness and equality.
Resources should be allocated to those who need them.
They hear the preaching of socialism about equality, but they don't look on what it actually delivers. The history of humanity is of poverty, starvation, early death. This was true throughout our history until very recently. In the last 20 years, we've seen more humans escape extreme poverty than any other time in human history, and that's because of markets.
After last summer's protests, experts declared what America must do for Black Americans.
The only way to close a wealth gap is by transferring wealth.
We have to abolish policing.
Reparations.
Listening to them, I kept hearing the voice of Tom Sowell.
I haven't been able to find a single country in the world where the policies that are being advocated for Blacks in the United States have lifted any people out of poverty.
Sowell's an economist who writes great books about economics and culture. Today, he defends free markets and criticizes the conceit of political planners. But he once was a Marxist.
What was your wake up to what was wrong with that line of thinking?
Facts.
Thomas Sowell was born in North Carolina at the start of the Great Depression. His father died before he was born, his mother soon after. When he was nine, a relative took him to Harlem.
We were much poorer than the people in Harlem or most other anywhere else today. But in another sense, in the sense of the things you need to get ahead, I was enormously more fortunate than most Black kids today.
Partly because a friend showed him the Harlem Public Library.
When you start getting in the habit of reading when you're 8 years old, that's a different ballgame.
His reading and early life experiences turned him into a Marxist.
So I would take the Fifth Avenue bus past all these Lord and Taylor and all these fancy places. And then suddenly, there were the tenements. And I wondered, why is this? It's so different. And nothing in the schools or most of the books seemed to deal with that. And Marx dealt with that.
What then changed him was his first job.
I was a summer intern at the U.S. Department of Labor. One of my biggest concerns was about minimum wages. At first, I thought, well, this is good because all these people are poor and they'll get a little higher income. And so that'll be helpful. And then as I studied economics, I began to see, well, there's a downside. They may lose their jobs completely. And when I came up with how we might test this, I was waiting to hear congratulations, you see, that I had this. And I could see these people were stunned. They said, oh, this idiot has stumbled on something that will ruin us all. And I realized the U.S. Department of Labor had its own agenda and interests. And that did not necessarily mean that whether poor people lost their jobs for minimum wages or got higher pay was their highest priority.
He found out that people in the government didn't give a rip whether or not it worked or didn't work. They were simply implementing the policy. And that's what shocked him and caused him to begin to rethink lots of his assumptions.
These video clips come from a new documentary about Seoul.
This whole notion that the black family has always been disintegrating, that is nonsense.
What I find most interesting about Seoul's work is that it utterly contradicts what Americans are taught about black poverty. Seoul says claims of systemic racism in America are propaganda.
If you go back into the 20s, you find that married couple families were much more prevalent among blacks then. As late as 1930, blacks had lower unemployment rates than whites. So all these things that we complain about and attribute to the era of slavery, those things should have been worse in the past than in the present.
Sowell says the bigger cause of blacks' problems today is welfare.
You began to have the mindset that goes with the welfare state so that there was no stigma any longer attached, for example, to being on relief.
The things they thought were going to help did not help, and in many cases made things worse. Sowell concluded that many government programs did much more harm than good because of affirmative action.
Something like 1/4 of all the black students going to MIT do not graduate. You're talking about a pool of people whom you are artificially turning into failures by mismatching them with the school.
Saying such things doesn't make Sowell popular with today's political elites, but he doesn't seem to care.
Tom is absolutely fearless. He will not compromise any of his opinions for the sake of social politeness.
And so today's politically correct media rarely give his work the attention it deserves.
The media, the television, and the print media, they've wised up. You can't argue with Tom, so you might as well hide what he's doing. And that's what they're doing. They're just ignoring what he's written because there's no way that they can argue with Tom Sowell.
Today, Sowell is a scholar at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He continues to write books about public policy. You can watch the full Sowell documentary at any of these sites starting next week.
We won't go until it's safe!
If teachers' unions get to decide, your child's school probably will not be open soon.
Right now, it is not safe.
If I die from catching COVID-19, from being forced back into Pinellas County Schools, you can drop my dead body right here. Leave my body right here.
The unions stage protests and spend on ads that say opening schools means
students and teachers forced to put their health and safety at risk.
Forced to put their health and safety at risk.
191 countries. There is no consistent link between reopening schools and increased rates of COVID transmission.
Education researcher Lindsay Burke points out that science shows schools rarely are spreading COVID.
But it's logical that they would be. The kids are bunched together.
The positivity rates in schools are generally below those in the broader community.
Studies on tens of thousands of people do find closing schools made no difference.
Close the bars and keep the schools open.
Because America hasn't done that.
Elementary and middle school students are falling behind.
Kids are social animals. The lack of their ability to interact in person, to see their friends, to see their teachers is really having an impact.
Though less impact on children of the privileged, they often escape the shutdowns. In California,
98.8% of our schools have closed down.
But not his kids' school.
His kids' private school stayed open.
Yeah, choice for me, but not for thee.
We understand that in-person learning is more effective than online teaching, but that's not the question. The question is what is safest.
The union would say it's better than people dying.
But that's really not at the heart of why unions are trying to keep schools closed. It's really a question of politics.
Union demands do include things unrelated to teacher safety. In Los Angeles,
The demands include implementing a moratorium on private schools, increasing taxes on the wealthy, implementing Medicare for all.
The union said it would not bless school reopening until they defunded the police.
You conservatives are just doing what you criticize liberals for doing. You're cherry picking Los Angeles, the worst extreme example of crazy teachers unions. That's not the norm.
It's not just Los Angeles. The Oregon Education Association, the teachers union there, said they wanted the state to halt any transfers to virtual charter schools.
Virtual charters.
Go ahead and read today's warm-up question.
Okay, so today's warm-up is, how do you use electrical currents?
There's clearly not any sort of health, school safety issue in a virtual setting, and yet they opposed transfers to virtual charter schools.
It's telling that at a time when most businesses beg to be allowed to open.
We need to reopen. We need to reopen.
And non-union schools are open.
Catholic schools, they opened on time in September.
Government-run schools stayed closed. Why? Here's one reason.
District public schools continue to receive funding regardless.
Union workers get paid without having to work. Not working sometimes seems to be a goal. Union executive Sarah for Justice tweeted, "Teachers should stay home because school's unsafe." She tweeted while saying she was enjoying pool life in Puerto Rico.
Only when it's safe.
The unions keep winning. Congress's latest stimulus package blocks any funds from going to school choice. And all over America, union schools remain closed.
It is a demonstration of the power of collective action to get things done.
That's nice for the unions, but it's a big loss for students, parents, and taxpayers. We ask 20 teachers' unions, please appear in this video, refute what your critics say. Not one would. Happy New Year. Hope you like these videos. They exist thanks to you, people like you. So to help us make more, please press that button. This is a fancy restaurant. At the French Laundry, dinners can cost $800. It's so luxurious that the late Anthony Bourdain said,
"This is like driving a Rolls Royce naked in mink underpants."
But because of COVID, we shouldn't eat here. It's in California where the governor says,
"It's absolutely essential avoiding mixing with people that are outside of your households."
Okay, we won't go. But wait, look at this picture.
Governor Gavin Newsom dining at the luxurious French Laundry restaurant.
No masks anywhere and multiple households against his own rules. Now, you might have heard about Newsom's hypocrisy, but it was worse than we thought.
Politicians' priorities will always be put first.
Jarrett Stepman of the Daily Signal reports on politicians' hypocrisy.
It was a friend's birthday party. He had some obligation to go to that.
This is not just simply a friend. This is a powerful lobbyist who's there to get exemptions for powerful people in the state of California.
The governor's friend is a fixer who gets his clients exemptions from lockdowns. Clients like Hollywood firms so they can keep working while others can't.
I'm losing everything. Everything I own is being taken away from me.
This woman had remodeled her restaurant for COVID.
All the work I did for outdoor dining, for tables being 7 feet apart.
Her kind of dining was suddenly forbidden. But not for the politically connected.
They set up a movie company right next to my outdoor patio.
They're allowed to have outdoor dining right next to her restaurant.
Tell me that this is dangerous, but right next to me as a slap in my face, that's safe.
She doesn't have a powerful team of lobbyists who can argue on her behalf in the state's capital.
California has lots of hypocritical politicians. You heard about Nancy Pelosi.
Surveillance video shows her at a hair salon getting a blowout and not wearing a face mask.
In Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves held three Christmas parties.
Seems to fly in the face of guidance from his own health advisors.
How is that not in conflict with the order?
It allows us to really send a message to the people of Mississippi that you can return to a life that is somewhat normal.
Normal for politicians.
Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo maskless at a wine bar Friday night. This just days after sending a tweet telling people to, quote, stay home except for essential activities.
There is this feeling, Governor, that you are constantly lecturing people about the rules. Some people look at that picture and think it's hypocritical.
That night, we were absolutely following the rules. I was with my household, wearing a mask.
Washington, D.C.'s mayor demanded a 14-day quarantine for anyone going to states like Delaware for non-essential activity. But then she went to Delaware to celebrate Joe Biden. Her excuse?
I do a lot of things to advance the interests of the District of Columbia. And some of them are formal and some of them are informal, but all of them are necessary.
If politicians do it, it's always necessary. President Biden declared that masks must be worn on all federal property. And then he and his family almost immediately broke his own rule at the Lincoln Memorial. Donald Trump was a hypocrite, too.
When needed, I wear a mask.
He agreed to presidential debate rules requiring everyone to wear masks before the debate began. But he and his family didn't. And as it turned out, he had COVID then.
I think this was a blessing from God that I caught it.
At least Trump didn't dance in Times Square.
Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, dancing in an almost empty Times Square.
After telling New Yorkers not to come here on New Year's Eve.
It was like something out of the Hunger Games.
The presidential palace, the party of the year.
In Chicago, when salons were closed, the mayor got a haircut.
A photo that surfaced on social media showing the mayor after getting a trim has some asking, what about me?
I take my personal hygiene very seriously. As I said, I felt like I needed to have a haircut.
She was a double hypocrite, really.
Country.
She was seen attending election day parties and giant street festivals, not wearing a mask. She said, well, you know, the people simply deserve a night of fun. What about all the other people? What about their ideas of fun?
Politicians' hypocrisy is everywhere. The Heritage Foundation tracks it. They give at least 50 examples.
Politicians have one set of standards to follow, and we have another. And it's up to us to say, you're either going to follow those rules, you're going to change those rules, or we're going to throw you out.
While you're throwing them out, please help us make more videos. Click that button.
And I think Americans are facing a greater threat than just about everybody else. It's the U.S. dollar that I think is going to be the epicenter of the next crisis. You know, I rose to notoriety for predicting the 2008 financial crisis. Well, it's the same dynamics that created that crisis that are leading to this next crisis. And it's just much worse. And the consequences are going to be much greater for the people who aren't prepared for it. So I'm trying to get people out of dollars, out of dollar assets, build good portfolios outside the U.S., foreign equities, both developed and emerging markets, foreign bonds, take advantage of what I think will be a historic rise in gold and silver prices by having exposure to those metals, but also to the companies that mine them and make, you know, make a profit from selling them. So I think there's not only a way to protect your wealth, but a real way to enhance it. If you understand the dynamics of what's really going on, and then you position yourself for the end game. Yeah, well, the most risky things to own really long-term is just the paper, which would be the physical dollars, right? You know, dollars stuffed under your mattress, right? The cash you have, you know, are lying around. But also any paper dollars, you know, where you've loaned them out to somebody and you own a bond, whether you own a U.S. Treasury bond, a municipal, you know, bond, corporate bond, whatever, you know, paper that you're just going to get paid back dollars in the future, right? That's going to get wiped out. If you have, you know, cash value in an insurance policy, you know, maybe you have a whole life policy with a cash value surrender policy, an annuity, a fixed annuity that pays you a quantity of dollars, right? All of those things, that's the worst thing to own because inflation just wipes those out, right? Then I think if you own U.S. stocks, all right, you own a real asset because you own a business and all their plant and equipment and, you know, whatever they own, their intellectual property, and it's an operating company. But to the extent that most of their customers are in America, they're just going to be earning dollars. And while they may be able to raise their prices in an inflationary environment, they may not be able to raise them enough to compensate for the loss in value, especially if we're in a big recession with a lot of inflation. So rather than taking refuge in U.S. stocks, and that would same thing would go for real estate, right? Because if you own real estate, right, you're out of paper, you own something real. But if you want to rent it out, who are your potential tenants? Well, they're people that have dollars, right? I mean, it's hard to rent out your U.S. property for Swiss francs or, you know, something like that. So what you want to do is you want to get income producing assets outside the United States that generate income in other currencies, not the dollar. And you want to be in countries that have better, you know, underlying fundamentals. They're not going to have the currency crisis that we're going to have. They're not going to have this massive economic collapse. And they're not on the verge of, you know, going all in on socialism like we are. You know, so you can look at other places in the world that are freer, that have less regulation, lower tax rates, lower deficits, better balance of trade, creditor nations instead of debtor nations. And invest there, buy stocks there, buy real estate there. Although,
but so why do you stand so opposed to the Janet Yellen and the Jerome Powell of the world who say, hey, if we spend big now, we're going to have such a strong economy that we don't have to worry about inflation. We'll pay off all our debt and we'll be in a better position.
Well, we actually have different agendas. You see, I actually care about the country and I want it to prosper and succeed in the long run. Whereas what Powell and Yellen want is to kick the can down the road, to the next election. So all they're trying to do is delay the day of reckoning. They don't care or even understand how much worse that day is going to be because of the delay, because all the delay does is allow the underlying problems to get worse. And that's basically what they're doing.
Now, what happens if inflation doesn't come, though? Does that start throwing a wrench in the gear of we need to move away from the dollar? I mean, the odd thing that's happening now, and we've seen obviously over the last 10, 11 years, is we've been in this quantitative easing phase, actually probably more like 12 years now, and that inflation hasn't come yet. What's your take on that?
Well, that's because the inflation is already here, right? You don't have to wait for it to arrive. Quantitative easing is inflation. It's just a different name for the same thing, except that, you know, people don't necessarily like inflation. So if the Fed said our policy is creating inflation, right? People say, well, wait a minute, I don't like inflation. That makes my cost of living go up. So instead of saying we're going to create inflation, they'll say, oh, we're just going to do quantitative easing. Oh, that sounds pretty good, right? But that's inflation, because inflation literally means to expand. That's where the word comes from. Inflate, right? A balloon inflates, right? It expands. You're filling it with air. Prices don't expand. Right? They can go up, they can go down, but they don't expand. So what is expanding? An expansion of the money supply, right? Deflation is a contraction. Just like a balloon can deflate, your money supply can deflate. Now, we don't contract the money supply. We keep expanding it. So we keep creating inflation. Now, one of the results of expanding the money supply is that prices will go up, right? So that's an effect of inflation, but that's not the inflation itself. So the question that you're really asking me is, when are we going to see all this inflation show up to a greater degree at the supermarket, right? Stuff like that, right? And it's hard to say, right? I mean, we know eventually that's where it's all going. But right now, a lot of the inflation has pushed up asset prices, right? That's also an effect of inflation. Stock market is going up because of inflation. It's not because of higher earnings or a better economy. It's inflation that is bidding up stock prices. The same thing with real estate prices. Same thing with bond prices or all sorts of collectibles or rare things or cryptocurrencies. I mean, inflation is driving all these prices up. But eventually, all of that inflation is going to go into consumer goods because assets are a means to an end, right? People, let's say you buy a stock. You're not buying a stock because you want to hang the certificate on the wall and admire it, right? You're buying a stock because you hope to earn more money that you can use to buy more stuff. So ultimately, the stock is a means to get more stuff. So when people want to sell their stocks and buy the stuff, that's when the price of the stuff really starts to go up. Because thanks to the Fed, everybody is so levered up with debt, if they try to pull the rug out from under that house of cards, the whole thing is going to collapse. So the Fed is caught between a rock and a hard place, And so inflation is going to run rampant, which is why you better be prepared for it.
What do you say, though, to the potential that, hey, we could keep printing money if the velocity of money goes down? What if people are becoming more investor savvy or more saver, you know, pay down debt, and maybe they're just not spending as much, and maybe that's not going to lead to higher prices. So maybe we just keep printing.
Well, yeah, you can pretend that that's the case until you're confronted with a crisis. And the problem is, if you do that, it's like, you know, you've got all this rope, and but if you fasten it into a noose, you know, and jump, you know, put it right, you're gonna hang just because you have a longer rope. But just, you know, as long if there's enough distance between the limb and, you know, and the ground, right? That's what we've done. We just assume that, oh, okay, we're, you know, we can postpone it, but we can't. And the problem is, once inflation becomes a problem, we have no way to deal with it, because there's only one thing you can do, right? So interest rate and prices really start to rise, right? The Fed says they're comfortable with 2% inflation. Right. Now they say, okay, it's okay if it goes a little bit above. What that is, we're not really sure, you know, because they don't know. But let's say it's 3% and they say, okay, that's not that bad. It's not that far. You know, we were at 1, now we're at 3. It averages out to 2. Then it gets to 4, then it gets to 5, 6. At what point, oh my God, it's 6%, it's 7%. We need to do something. Now, if you let inflation get to 6 or 7%, how do you stop it? Well, maybe you have to raise interest rates to 10% or 15%. But what? I mean, we can't even afford 1%. We have so much debt, it's impossible. So once that inflation genie is out of the bottle, we don't have a prayer of putting it back in. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Fed pretends that it wants more inflation is because it knows that it can't do anything about it. So they want to pretend that, you know, they want inflation, that's a good thing. The reality is that's an awful thing, but they're not going to do anything to protect us from it, because they've set up a situation where, in their mind, the cure for inflation is worse than the disease.